Good afternoon, and we are back on WAMC. It is Vox Pop. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Shar, talk on Medical Monday. And joining us today is Dr. Eric Plakin, senior psychiatrist at the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and past member of the clinical faculty at Harvard. Dr. Plakin is a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, a past chair of its Committee on Psychotherapy by Psychiatrists, past member of the APA Assembly Executive Committee, and current chair of the Assembly Task Force on Psychotherapy by Psychiatrists. And Dr. Plakin, welcome back.
Well, nice to be back, Bob, although I have to say I'm glad I caught you on your last day and sorry to see you going.
See me, you know, just get me as I'm walking out the door. That's it. If you'd like to participate in today's conversation, please get in right now. The number is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. And before we get to your calls, Doctor, there's some controversy going on now about the new DSM-5. Could you just give us a quick explanation of what that is and why it's controversial?
Sure. And I should say what the DSM is. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual published by the American Psychiatric Association. And for the past 20 years or so, we have been using DSM-4, the fourth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And over the last, close to a decade, there's been considerable work by the American Psychiatric Association, but including professionals from other disciplines like psychology, developing the new manual. It's been headed by a senior psychiatrist named David Kupfer. When he was asked several months ago, what was the most surprising thing that happened in the course of the development of DSM-5? He said it was that he turned up on the front page of the New York Times. Who would think that this manual would cause such a stir? And it has caused quite a stir in the field and around the field. And maybe sometime we'll do a show on the manual itself. That's not what I'm here to do today. But there's been quite a bit of controversy, and some of it's been about the way that diagnostic categories have been changed, and a bit of a struggle between those who believe that we need to have the best we can in terms of description of syndromes so that we can treat people, and those often represented by the National Institute of Mental Health and Tom Insel, the director there, who really want to have biologically based, genetically based diagnostic standards. The trouble is, the research that I'm seeing isn't suggesting that we're going to find genes related to the vulnerability for mental illness. We're much more likely to find that the environment works in profoundly powerful ways, much more powerful than we thought when we decoded the human genome, and that we're going to find that experience, environment, the nurture side as opposed to nature is far more important than a lot of us in the field have thought. Although some of us have been suspecting that right along. Actually, I wanted to mention that I take up this and some other issues in a brand new blog on the Austin Riggs website. And listeners are welcome to call in, leave comments, or continue the discussion that we have today on that website. Riggs is www.austinriggs.org, and it's AustenRiggs.org. So that's a new thing that I've been experimenting with, and perhaps we'll find some links to this in what we talk about today.
Okay. Just talking about DSM-5, how old was DSM-4?
Well, DSM-4 was about 20 years old.
Okay.
And it's been systematically replaced, as new learning comes in, and there are specific controversies. For example, a number of calls that I've gotten over the years on this show have been about what's called Asperger's disorder, which is a form of pervasive developmental disorder. And as it turns out, it was useful to introduce that diagnosis in DSM-4, but it didn't seem to have hard boundaries that separated it from other what are called autism spectrum disorders in DSM-5. So the category has been renamed autism spectrum disorders, and Asperger's disorder is gone. And that led to some lay response because people felt like their identity had been taken away, and no one who had the one disorder would have their everyone who had the disorder Asperger's would continue to meet criteria. Right. For the new autism spectrum disorder. And then there's been some reaction to a new category. I don't know that I have the name right, but it's something about dysregulation of mood. And you see things, for example, in the scientific and the lay press about, are we now going to diagnose every temper tantrum as a mental disorder in a youngster? And of course, that's not the point of it.
I've been doing that with my child for years now.
Well, you can, yeah. But I'm a psychiatrist and I wouldn't diagnose them on the basis of a tantrum. The point was really that too many children were being diagnosed with childhood bipolar disorder. And that seemed to go well beyond any data or knowledge that we had. And so they introduced this new dysregulation of mood and behavior disorders so that there was a way, short of a bipolar disorder, to say, look, there's something worth noticing here. This is not an ordinary tantrum, but these parents have brought this child to attention of clinicians because they're concerned about the way it seems much different from their friends or what other families are talking about. And it's not to stigmatize more children with diagnoses, but instead not to reach for a diagnosis like bipolar disorder so frequently.
Okay. The number is 1-800-348-2551. Let's get to your calls. We're going to start with Steve in Chichester, New York. Steve, good afternoon.
Hello there. Thank you. Hello, Bob and Eric. I have suffered from borderline personality disorder since around 1983. I'm now 62 years old. I'd like to ask Dr. Plagan about the efficacy of pharmacological treatment for this disorder.
Okay, thank you, Steve. An interesting question and an area of intense interest to me as well as to you. And let me first say something about what borderline personality is, a borderline personality disorder. The DSM-4 described mental disorders on multiple axes. Axis 1 was the major psychiatric syndromes like major depressive disorder or schizophrenia or anorexia nervosa. And then there was an axis 2 that was designated for personality disorders. Now, there were advantages and disadvantages to this multi-axial system, which, by the way, in DSM-5 has been eliminated.
Oh.
There's no longer axis 1 and axis 2. The plus side of the old multi-axial system where there was an axis 2 for personality disorders was that it made clinicians stop and think about, well, was there a personality contribution to this person's difficulties? The downside is that insurance companies tended to treat axis 2 disorders as second-class disorders, even though there's a very significant mortality from suicide as a result of borderline personality disorder. I'm
right.
Pleased that you know, you're obviously still alive or you wouldn't be calling in.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, it's easy for clinicians to think of these so-called axis 2 disorders like borderline personality disorder as something less important. And in fact, I often say in lectures around the country that the most frequently made axis 2 diagnosis by psychiatric clinicians is deferred, meaning they've decided to postpone making a decision. The reason that's unhelpful and in fact potentially harmful is one of the things we're learning is that the presence of borderline personality disorder makes other disorders, like, for example, major depression or a bipolar disorder, far more difficult to treat. You're much more likely to fail treatment for a major depressive disorder if you have borderline personality disorder than if you don't. Now, as to what borderline personality disorder is, it's a habitual way of interacting in relationships and in work settings that is impairing, that involves troubles with being alone, troubles with identity and a sense of who one is, often is involved with impulsive and potentially self-destructive behaviors. There are, someone once calculated, almost 100 9 to meet the 9 criteria for borderline personality disorder.
Oh, my.
So no two people are necessarily exactly the same, and we don't need to and probably shouldn't get into the specifics of what you've struggled with around this. But
sure.
But you're asking really a question about the pharmacology of it and the medication treatments. And here's what I'd say. The American Psychiatric Association publishes practice guidelines on disorders and says, look, this is the best evidence for what the treatment should be for this disorder. One of them is on borderline personality disorder. It is the only disorder for which the principal treatment is some form or another of psychotherapy. That is the use of a human relationship as an agent of change. And there are different kinds of psychotherapy from different schools. However, medications do play a useful role in treating either some of the symptoms of borderline personality disorder or in treating so-called comorbid disorders, that is, additional disorders that are present even when someone has borderline personality disorder. As I said a moment ago, major depressive disorder is that much more difficult to treat if borderline personality disorder is there. But you'd want to treat the major depressive disorder, where a first-line treatment is medication, even while you are using a psychotherapeutic treatment for the borderline personality disorder. And in borderline personality disorder itself, as I said, medications can be useful. For example, if someone, as people sometimes do who have borderline personality disorder, sometimes has trouble holding themselves together and has moments when they have trouble knowing what is real and what isn't, and can be can become quite intensely certain of something that is simply not true, sometimes the so-called neuroleptic drugs can be helpful as a kind of what you might think of, we call it in the field, ego glue, to help someone hold together. If someone is prone to a lot of sadness and depression in the borderline personality disorder, they might receive an antidepressant. If someone has a lot of mood instability, they sometimes wind up on mood stabilizers. These are often, I'd say that it's some of the antidepressant drugs that are the best, most widely used in borderline personality disorder. They often help with some anxiety, with some depressed mood, and with a tendency toward impulsive behavior that can be part of the disorder. But medications are not the first-line treatment for borderline personality disorder.
I've actually spoken to Dr. Marshall Linehan, who is probably the nation's leading authority on dialectic behavior therapy, which has shown great efficacy as far as a psychotherapeutic treatment for borderline. But I have been unable to find anybody in the Hudson Valley region who practices it or who offers it.
That's interesting. Marshall Linehan is, in fact, the person who created and developed dialectical behavior therapy called DBT. And it is it's a form of therapy that teaches skills in managing intense feelings. You know, the trick to living one's life is being able to manage intense feelings. And the trick to being able, for example, for somebody to be able to be an outpatient treatment is to do the work they need to in sessions and manage intense feelings between the sessions so they can go to work or go to school or be in relationships until the next session when they can go back to work again. DBT is one of six evidence-based treatments that I and some others in what's called the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry Psychotherapy Committee have sat down together, and we've said, look, if there are six different psychotherapies, turns out three behavioral ones like dialectical behavioral therapy, and three psychodynamic ones like transference-focused psychotherapy, and the one that comes from Riggs is called alliance-based intervention for suicide. If there are six evidence-based treatments, then let's have a group of experts sit down together, become knowledgeable about those six treatments, and let's see if we can find common factors across all six of them. And, you know, the reason that's important is precisely the point you raised, Steve, and that is you're having trouble finding anyone in the Hudson Valley who is trained in DBT. Now, I think if you went a little bit further south toward Westchester, there are, at New York Hospital, there are excellent people, and they might know who's in the Hudson River Valley and worth your making a call and checking that out. But it's a lot harder to produce DBT-trained therapists than it is to treat to teach therapists Here are the six, as it turns out, we found six common factors across all the forms of therapy. And if you use these, you'll probably provide better treatment for patients with borderline personality disorder. This is a paper we've just been doing, actually, and it's just being submitted for publication, now. So it's exactly the problem. The problem is, even though there are these evidence-based treatments, how do people get access?
Right.
And you know, please do understand, though, that there are not, it isn't only DBT, and there are certainly very skilled therapists for borderline personality disorder who don't use DBT at all. At a place like Austin Riggs, for example, we use a psychodynamic approach that's intensive four times a week. It's only really required for, you know, a small subset of people, but we use some DBT skills to help people learn to manage intense feelings between sessions, and it's part of what we teach within our largely psychodynamic rather than behavioral treatment program.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I don't want to take up too much more time. I know there's more callers, but thank you very much for the information. I'll be watching your blog.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Good luck.
1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. 1-800-348-2551. The discussion's just getting started. Give us a call with your questions. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, providing educational and residential programs, diagnosis, and treatments for children and adults. AndersonCenterForAutism.org. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting pure photography, pictorial, and modern photographs from the Syracuse University Art Collection. Now through July 20th, ArkellMuseum.org. Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. And Riverbend Animal Hospital, Route 9 in Hadley, Massachusetts, providing small animal medicine and wellness care, general and referral surgery, canine rehabilitation, laser therapy, and dentistry. RiverbendAnimal.com. And we are back on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. Our guest today on Medical Monday is Dr. Eric Plakin, senior psychiatrist at the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And, Doctor, you mentioned before that you've started a blog on the Austin Riggs site. Now, what types of different subjects are being reviewed in this blog?
Well, there's a number of blogs. I'm certainly not the only one who's blogging on the Riggs website. But I've recently decided that I wanted to start talking about what I'm concerned about in the field. You know, and I'm a member of organized psychiatry. I'm involved in the American Psychiatric Association Assembly and in other ways in the leadership of the American Psychiatric Association. But I'm concerned about the kind of biological reductionism that the field has tended to shift toward. And so I'm talking about what I think are four false assumptions that are worth the field noticing and correcting. They are, just to list them, this belief that genes are going to explain mental illness. I don't think the evidence is pointing that way. They are that patients present with just one disorder. As in the conversation with Steve a couple of moments ago, I think most often people don't have one disorder. They have so-called comorbid disorders, and that's extremely typical. And in fact, among the people who present with major depression, a very common and important psychiatric disorder, it looks like about 80% have other disorders. Mm. Number three, the third false assumption is that that patients will respond to a single evidence-based treatment. And that's a flawed assumption because these treatments are tested and their efficacy found generally on the patients who have just one disorder, which is not the way most patients are. And fourth, I think the fourth false assumption is that medications are the most important way we have of treating patients. And we're learning a great deal about the way that we have overestimated the efficacy of the medications. By the way, I'm not saying they don't work or that they shouldn't work. I am saying that if you look at the evidence and you look at all the studies, not just the ones that got published because they had positive results, but if you look at all the studies, it looks like we, for example, overestimated the effect, the efficacy of antidepressant drugs by about a third, and that much of the benefit of these drugs is the so-called placebo effect. It has nothing to do with the chemistry of the drug. It has much more to do with the patient's expectations, the patient's readiness to change, the relationship with the doctor. And I think these false assumptions are worth the field stopping and taking a look at, because I think it's time to rethink some of them.
1-800-348-2551. That's the number. Let's go back to your calls. We have John from Albany. John, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
This is John. I had a question. I have two children that were diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, specifically with an Asperger's diagnosis. And you talked a little bit at the beginning of the show about how that diagnosis is changing. But one of my daughters who is undiagnosed, I've noticed still suffers high levels of anxiety. And I was just wondering if the connection has been made between those two things and what is would be like the best treatment plan for her going forward. Not necessarily treatment plan, but what would be the best steps to take with her.
How old is your daughter?
She's 6, almost 7.
Okay. Well, thanks for the question, John. I'm sorry your kids are struggling. And you know, as you're right that there was a I like the language you use because it was the right language that there you seem to have a child with an autism spectrum problem. And indeed, that's what we've been figuring out. You know, diagnoses, we would all like it to be the way it is perhaps in cardiology. You know, if you're having an acute myocardial infarction because your left anterior descending coronary artery is blocked, that's a very precise diagnosis. And
sure.
The treatment's quite precise as well. You want to get that clot out and maybe put a stent in. That we'd love it if it was like a strep throat. Well, there's beta hemolytic streptococcus group A growing on the throat, and so penicillin will take care of it. The trouble is that isn't how minds work. That we aren't going to ever, I think, be able to get to that level of precision. And we try to put together the best studies we can to see what syndromes there are and to think about what treatments there are. And I think that in the range of the autism spectrum disorders, there's a group of them along a spectrum. And it sounds like some of your kids are struggling with that. I think the thing to do is take them to a competent child psychiatrist or psychologist and have them carefully evaluated individually. And also, I think when we're talking about kids of this age, within the family context, you know, and see how much is learned behavior and how much is part of the individual disorder of the child. I think that's the thing to do. And I think that there are a number of approaches. Sometimes medications are quite helpful with symptoms like anxiety that can be part of these disorders. Sometimes behavioral approaches are quite good. And sometimes social kinds of treatment in which there are groups or other kinds of milieu settings are useful. A lot depends on the details that are far beyond what we're going to get into in the radio. But I think a competent child or psychologist or psychiatrist would be the right person to take someone like this to get an assessment.
I guess my last question would be, what is the appropriate age if she does have anxiety issues, especially going on into puberty? What is the appropriate age to medicate a child that has those issues?
Yeah, there's not a simple answer, but I think that medication, look, anxiety is a price we pay for civilization. We are anxious beings because we are in conflict. Sometimes, and that anxiety is generally a signal of that conflict, of something else. I sometimes talk about anxiety as like the check engine light on the dashboard of your car. And it isn't always the best idea to figure out how just to turn it off. It may indicate that there's something going on inside. Obviously, in a you know discussion like this, there isn't much I can say about the about your daughter's anxiety. But I think the use of medication in children should be weighed extremely carefully, because anxiety is likely to be very long-standing, and that doesn't necessarily mean you want to have somebody on an anti-anxiety medication for a very, very long time.
Okay, John, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Quickly, I want to tell you that there is a severe thunderstorm warning now for northern Albany County, west central Rensselaer County, southern Saratoga County, and Schenectady County in east central New York. This warning, the watch is going to be on till 9 o'clock, but the warning is on till 3:15 this afternoon. Again, severe thunderstorm warning. Northern Albany County, west central Rensselaer County, southern Saratoga County, and Schenectady County in east central New York. Not to add to anybody's anxiety. Let's go now to Susan in North Adams. Susan, good afternoon.
Whoa, what was that?
That's your own, Susan.
No, I heard a bleep in the phone. I said, my question. Attention deficit disorder. I think that teachers should be aware, because even years ago, like 30 years ago, all the people that had bipolar disorder as children, okay, were diagnosed as ADD and they were given Ritalin, which made it worse. And I think that the only distinction between the two is they both mimic each other in their symptoms. But the only way you can tell between a child that has ADD and having these symptoms plus this, another child that has bipolar disorder and is exhibiting the same kind of symptoms is he wants to be or she wants to be number one. You can't take blood tests. You can't take, anything, family history. Stuff like that is important. But I have experienced years ago all my children being diagnosed with ADD, and all of them have bipolar disorder. So I'm speaking through experience.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, Sue. What is your question?
My question basically is, I think that people also are being, especially children, are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. It's almost like as if it is a new fad. In 1989, when I had a psychotic breakthrough, no one even basically even heard about it.
Well, you know,
it
seems
like nowadays,
I'm sorry, there's no question coming. Do you agree with this, Doctor?
Well, Susan, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think there's a couple of things that you're saying that probably we should address. One is, absolutely, we have to watch out for overdiagnosis of any disorder, and the symptoms of attention deficit disorder, where a child may be hyperactive and inattentive. It can be an attention deficit disorder. It can be something else. The something else could be bipolar disorder, and the something else could be trouble in the family, trouble at home. It could be an autism spectrum disorder, and I've seen all of these things happen. I think we want to watch out for overdiagnosing children, and I also think we want to pay attention, especially in young children, with their family context, and not only think of a model in which disease is located in an individual, it can be located in a system like a family. But I certainly think that it's true that we want to watch out for missing diagnoses, and bipolar disorder is important because there are useful treatments for it. But it can also, therefore, be overdiagnosed, and we can see it everywhere. And I hope it sounds like your children have been properly diagnosed, and I hope we're on the road to
they're
to doing
adults
well.
Right now.
Good.
But they all did have it, and I do too. And I wrote a book called, it'll be out pretty soon, it's called Madness Broke the Rose.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. We appreciate
it.
1-800-348-2551. I tell you what, we'll take a quick break now, and then we'll come right back with the rest of your calls.
Support for WAMC comes from Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley, gastroenterology and urology specialists with offices in Dutchess, Ulster, and Orange counties. PremierMedicalHV.com. Adelphi University, Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Tuesday, July 9th, 6 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Pavilion, connect.adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley Events. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, take-out, delivery. 518-432-0358. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. And Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, one- and two-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. TPSAlbany.com for reservations. And we are back on Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Shartok. And our guest today is Dr. Eric Plakin, senior psychiatrist at the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And we've got some calls waiting for us, doctor, so let's get right back to them. We have Debbie in Kingston on the line. Debbie, good afternoon. Hello, Debbie? It said two. I pressed two. We'll continue on here. Let's go to Lauren in Albany. Lauren, good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
So my question is, I'm a transgendered individual, and the DRM is sort of the Bible that one has to go through in order to get to the goal. I was just curious what the new edition has, and has anything changed? Are there updates, or has everything stayed the same?
Well, Lauren, great question. I think perhaps in the future we'll want to do a show on DSM-5 and exactly what's changed. I'm still making my way through it, and I haven't gotten as far as the transgender section, so I can't really answer your question. What I do know is that there's a very active LGBT group that is part of the leadership of the American Psychiatric Association, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, you know, and gender issue group. And this group has had a great deal of influence in shaping the diagnostic categories. Three or four editions ago, even something like homosexuality, I think it was in DSM-1, was considered pathological, and that's not at all the case. In fact, the APA has taken a clear stand that this is not a disorder, although people with any gender expression can have disorders of various kinds. I'm not really able to go over in detail what the differences are in the transgender definitions in DSM-5, but hope to be able to do that in a later show.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Well,
thanks for your call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Edward in Hudson. Edward, good afternoon. Nope, and that one's off. Let's go to three. That's Cindy in Saratoga Springs. Cindy, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hi. My question is actually for my husband. He's been on for depression for about a week now, and he's not feeling well with it, and I guess I understand that can happen for a while. But he's also a very heavy drinker. And I saw on the commercial for Cymbalta on TV the other day that one of the side effects can be liver disease, and a lot of other really sort of scary and I think pretty severe side effects. And I'm just wondering, this being his first time on an antidepressant medication, would there be something else that would be maybe have less side effects or less severe side effects and wouldn't have... especially for somebody who drinks a lot.
Okay, there's a question. We're having a terrible time with your phone line there, Cindy. We're sorry about that, but we'll try to get your answer in now.
Yeah, Cindy, it's a terrific question. Cymbalta, duloxetine, is an antidepressant drug. It's many people are familiar with the so-called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the ones like Prozac and Celexa. Cymbalta is a a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It works on two different neurotransmitters. Now, your question's an interesting one because we're talking again about the issue of comorbidity. That is, you're telling me that two things seem to be going on. There's both excessive drinking and depression. And you can see how it complicates the picture because alcohol is itself a depressant. And it isn't a good idea to be drinking while taking antidepressant drugs. Alcohol can be toxic to the liver far more regularly than a drug like Cymbalta is, but it can still happen, and the two could be doubly toxic. I think there's a difficult situation if that's what's happening. Now, of course, one needs to pay careful attention to how your husband would be doing worse, or how he would be doing poorly, rather, I should say, on Cymbalta. Does it seem to be making him worse? If that's the case, it may well be that he needs to be off it. And it could be, as is sometimes the case with antidepressant drugs, that they can push someone from depression toward the opposite pole of bipolar disorder, that is, toward mania or increased irritability and euphoria. You know, it's not likely, but it's absolutely one of the things that a clinician would want to pay attention to when hearing a story like this. I think your husband should get in and see whoever prescribed the Cymbalta and do it fairly quickly to try to sort out whether there's an adverse reaction to the Cymbalta or it isn't working yet, and whether it's going to work at all, and if he doesn't find a way to get hold of substance use that sounds like it's problematic.
Yeah. Okay. Nope. And do you have any idea of a different kind of medication maybe that would be, you know, until he does get his drinking under control? He is seeing a counselor also.
All of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are good choices for the first time somebody is going on a medication for depression. But to be taking a substance that is a depressant while taking an antidepressant at the same time is creating an immovable force meeting an irresistible force meeting an immovable object kind of scenario. You don't want that. And I think that it may well be that medications won't work until the substance abstinence is achieved.
Okay. Cindy, thanks for your call. Good luck now.
Thank you very much.
1-800-348-2551. We have a few open lines. Let's go to Leo in Greenfield. Leo, good afternoon. Hello, Leo? Oh, let me try that again. Leo, you're there now.
Yes, okay, thank you.
It helps if I press the button. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I went through a divorce several years back, like 20 years ago, and the repercussions of using kids, and I really think it was through the attorneys that used the kids as power in a divorce, and then, you know, the repercussions years down the road when the kids are, they lose trust in one or the other of the parent, and I really think that the legal system pushes children to a place of power in a divorce, and I think that's so wrong. And if it happened in my very simple divorce, I suspect it happens all over.
Well, Leo, you describe a frequent problem. I mean, divorce is such a common thing in the country, and many children are dealing with the impact of parental divorce, sometimes when people remarry with blending families and moving on. Most of the time, this goes surprisingly smoothly. Well, maybe not so surprisingly. Most of the time, human beings are adaptable to loss, and they move on reasonably well. You seem to be describing a situation in which it sounds like there may have been a pretty significant legal battle in which kids get recruited as the sort of infantry foot soldiers of the fight between two parents, and you're suggesting that can have happened kind of with the enthusiastic support of lawyers.
Exactly.
It's an awful problem for kids to be in that position because it puts them in kind of loyalty binds about around different parents. And ideally, that's not where they should be, not a place for kids to get caught. And I wouldn't be surprised if that has consequences going forward. I don't know that there is necessarily a diagnosis for that. I suspect it's ordinary human sadness. And by ordinary, I don't mean unimportant. You know, I don't know that it's a diagnosable condition, but it is the kind of thing that sometimes can benefit from bringing it to a therapist or bringing the family to a family therapist and having a way to talk about what happened and what the impact is on this. In the worst case, I can imagine a kid being traumatized by being put in an impossible situation. But, you know, that would be an absolute worst case scenario. I'm sorry you've had that kind of trouble in the family, Leo, and that a couple of decades later, it sounds like it's still...
The repercussions are still there. And then I have another quick question, too.
Very quickly.
The Newtown, Connecticut thing and the one in Colorado and the one in Arizona, those kids that did these terrible, terrible deeds were obviously very disturbed, and it's never come out as to how they were being treated mentally or what kind of medications they were on.
Well, I'm not sure I know what the question is in that. I agree with you that those kinds of tragedies, sometimes when we hear of a tragedy like that, we assume that the person who carried it out was disturbed. However, we usually don't like it if someone then says they're going to use an insanity defense, and we feel like, oh, you know, they're trying to get off, as if an insanity defense often worked. It does not. And as if it meant that that one walked away scot-free. One does not. I think that we have to watch out for a tendency to stigmatize those with mental disorders as the perpetrators of violence in the society. Just as violence happens in people without mental illness, it happens in people with it. And I'm very mindful of the danger of deciding that everybody who carries this out has a mental disorder. Some do, and I think that various kinds of privacy rights mean that what may have been part of their treatment remains unavailable, except in the courtroom or to their treaters.
Okay. And Leo's line just went crazy there. We lost him. But I'd be more concerned about the kids who were the victims.
Yeah,
more
the survivors, the kids who've been through something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. We have a few open lines. We're going to go to George in Albany. George, good afternoon.
Yes. I wanted to refer back to the statement you made on the price of anxiety is, how'd you say that?
Anxiety is the price we pay for civilization.
Okay, yeah, right. I was just wanted to get your thoughts. Do you think that reflects the difficulty for the psychiatric community to deal with the problem?
I'm not sure I'm following what you mean. The difficulty, actually, we have... I guess the answer, George, is no. Let me explain. We have extraordinarily good anti-anxiety treatments. We have potent anti-anxiety drugs. The trouble is that they do work. And it isn't useful to people. If you follow my check engine light analogy that I used a few calls ago, where anxiety is a kind of an indication of a conflict going on inside. It's often referred to as signal anxiety. It's a signal that something is going on. If we simply turn off the check engine light, we may destroy the motor of the car. We have to pay attention to getting a full picture, and sometimes we're all too prone to name the symptom as an anxiety disorder and to prescribe something for it that makes the anxiety go away without paying attention to what the underlying issue is that really needs attention. I think that the ideal medication treatment for anxiety is one that lowers it enough to be manageable for the individual to be able to use a psychotherapy to explore what the underlying issues are and to get hold of them in a better way. So I don't think that comment has to do with a limitation in the field. I think the trouble is medications are too effective. So many people, not all, many people who use substances to extreme, alcohol or something else, are really treating anxiety or depression. And they're doing it in a way that works quite well, except they're paying a huge price in the price of addiction. And I think that the way I look at it, the optimal treatment is not eradicating the anxiety. That's not compatible with being a human being, but having it to be manageable enough that it can be engaged in other ways and understood and mastered.
Okay. Thank you for your call, George. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. And we lost... Is that there? Is two good? Okay. You know what I want to ask you? I did want to ask you one more question here, Doctor, and that's something that we hit on the health show quite a bit. And is there still a disparity between mental health and physical health when it comes to either society's outlook on it or even insurance companies' outlook on it?
Well, as you may know, the Mental Health Parity Act was passed a number of years ago, mm-hmm. but there's still quite a vigorous fight to implement it. The point being that that mental disorders ought to be treated and their treatments funded in the same way that we would a medical disorder. So in principle, parity is in place. In practice, it's part of the stigmatization of mental illness that it's treated from a funding perspective as something less than other disorders. And yes, we still have that problem.
1-800-348-2551. Can I go to three? I can go to three. Let's go to Paula in Woodstock. Paula, good afternoon.
Oh, hi there.
Hi.
Hey. I was wondering what your feelings were about doing nutritional testing for possible metabolic imbalances that could play a role in stress or anxiety or certain type of mental illness?
Yeah, well, Paula, it's a good question. And nutritional testing. Now, there are some things we know. For example, we know we've learned over the last decade or so that low levels of vitamin D seem to be associated with an increased risk of depression. And certainly there are specific deficiencies that are known to be associated with mental disorders. However, there is a good deal of treatment that is based on something other than science. Frankly, it's sometimes called junk science, mm-hmm. in which people look for things based on a personal belief rather than any real evidence. And I think that that can be a dangerous kind of wild goose chase. You know, 20 years ago, it was megavitamins. And of course, they've tended to drop out in favor of some other kinds of things. There's no clear evidence that the kinds of mental disorders that we commonly see are reliably related to any specific nutritional deficiencies. And in fact, most of the evidence is that there's not much connection.
Yes, you know, I was just thinking, you know, have been reading about if, in reference to autism, they're finding that there a lot of these children have problems with their gut, you know, with imbalance, and you know, there's reference to biochemical markers as far as testing.
Yeah, we would desperately love a biochemical marker for psychiatric disorders, and we do not have them. And yeah. and there just isn't evidence. You know, what was it? A few years ago, there was this level of certainty that ordinary childhood inoculations were causing autism, and it turned out to be completely wrong and made up data, falsified by a researcher who lost his professional standing because of that. And it adversely affected many people's lives by leading them to believe that there was evidence that somehow the ordinary kind of inoculations that a youngster gets contributes to autism. And it's not the case. You know, you give the inoculations at about the same age that autism spectrum disorders emerge. And so a reasonable person might raise the question of, oh, look, they had their shot a month ago, and now they're showing signs of an autism spectrum disorder. But there's just no evidence. When you do the science, there just isn't evidence of that. And I think we have to be on guard for those kinds of problems.
Yeah, I think the thing with the vaccines was the trimesterol, the mercury. And
turned out to be false.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's quickly go to Valerie in Lenox. Valerie, we have about 30 seconds.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, I wanted to ask about the idea of bipolar disorder, a spectrum disorder, and somebody who has been treated for 20-some-odd years for OCD with SSRIs has wonderful response, but then loses the response, tries another one, has a great response, loses it, sometimes takes Topamax in addition. And now I was speaking to a psychiatrist who said that 20 years ago we didn't know that there's some connection.
Okay, doctor, have you got a quick answer?
The quick answer, Valerie, is that
when
there are combined disorders, it's extraordinarily difficult to treat them, and you may be dealing with what's called a Prozac poop out. That is the SSRIs sometimes losing efficacy over time for reasons we do not understand.
And I'm sorry, we've got to cut you off right there. He'll be back, trust me. Thank you, Dr. Plakin. We apologize for the people we left on the phones. Support for WAMC comes from the Hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, health-quest.org for locations. Thanks to engineer Zach Malloy. Thanks to intern Hannah Hohenstein-Flack for answering the phones today. Producer is Patrick Dungis. I'm Bob Barrett. Alan Shartok back next week on Medical Monday. Join us next for the news.